Welcome to the Revolutionary Health Podcast. I am your host, Stephanie Center. I am a licensed clinician in search of how to live a meaningful and healthy life. I challenge both traditional and functional medicine ideologies in search of truth and wisdom. I allow room for curiosity and always keep an open mind. I enjoy deep conversations with my guests, giving them a safe space to share their research and personal observation, as I feel both equally contribute to the body of knowledge and human experience. Note that the opinions of my guests do not always reflect my own, whether I share that openly or not. And of course, the podcast is for educational purposes only. We do not offer medical advice. So grab a cup of coffee and join me for some intimate and unique discussions about finding wellness in the 21st century. Hello, welcome to Revolutionary Health. I am your host, Stephanie Center. I'm doing something a little bit different today. This podcast is available both auditorily, you know, on your favorite podcast platform, but I'm also showing it on YouTube because I recorded this episode in person live. I did my first live interview. You know, I started this podcast, gosh, almost 2 years ago because I was searching for answers and I wanted to know, you know, what it means to have a healthy life and how to achieve optimal health. And I wanted to learn different perspectives. I wanted to find people who thought differently from me. And that's exactly what I did. My guest today is a Nashville local. So we recorded this episode here in my kitchen where you see me right now, if you're watching this on YouTube. And this is the first time I've ever done that. So I'm really excited for this opportunity to share a visual with you. I will be sharing more podcast episodes on YouTube. I recently recorded an episode with Morley Robbins and Jim Stevenson Jr. on vitamin D, and there's a lot of visual slides in that one. So that one will be one that you will want to probably watch on YouTube. But yeah, I'm just trying to find better ways to serve my community. And what an awesome opportunity to start with Dr. Basil Kawash, because he is a physician that I really admire, and he's here in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Basil is a board-certified allergist and immunologist and an assistant professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University here in Nashville, Tennessee. His road to his medical career began in childhood with the challenges of exercise-induced asthma. And you all know that I love to choose guests who have a personal connection with their work. That's one thing that I really look for. I think it makes practitioners and physicians more compassionate, and it gives them that, you know, that personal experience that they can apply to their profession. During medical school and residency, Dr. Basil discovered the elegance of the immune system and his interest flourished. Dr. Basil is fortunate to have traveled widely and met professionals and learners from all over the world. He enjoys connecting with new people every day. If not about medicine, then about personal fitness, nutrition, or a shared love of electronic music. You can find him on Instagram at BasilMe, which I think is such a clever name. I love it. At Twitter, he's BasilMD0 and Clubhouse BasilMD. And I will link all of that in the show notes so you can just scroll on down and click and find him. I had a really good time with Dr. Basil. It was a really productive conversation between two people that have really different takes on a subject with the same goal of wanting to help people. So in this episode, we cover how the immune system works, what's the relationship between seasonal allergies and food allergies, how allergy testing works, and what's the gold standard testing. We look at, is there a way to treat food allergies holistically? We dive into what is histamine intolerance, because that's a growing concern. And there's some really interesting connections there. We talk about why foods like dairy, peanuts, and gluten are the most common allergies. And one thing that I really wanted to know and ask about was, you know, how do doctors who treat food allergies equip themselves with knowledge on nutrition? Because I know that that's not something that medical school really hones in on. But when you're an allergist, you're working a lot of times on, you know, diet-related conditions. So I just wondered, you know, how physicians go about filling in that gap. As always, if you like the show, hit the subscribe button, leave a review, or share it with a friend. I am a one-woman show. I do not advertise for this podcast. It grows because of you. So thank you so much for spreading the word and for your support. If you're interested in any of my programs or anything that I offer, I do some functional lab testing. You can visit my website at theholistichouse.org. All right, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Basil Kabash. All right, everybody, welcome back. We are doing something a little bit different today. I have with me here in person, Dr. Basil Kabash.
You got it, yeah.
Yes. Dr. Basil Kabash, who is a Vanderbilt physician in the area of allergies and immunology. I've gotten to know Dr. Basil through Clubhouse, actually, and he's a really thoughtful person, and I really appreciate his perspective, and I'm so grateful to have him on the show. As your host, I feel a responsibility to show you all different types of approaches to healing, and this includes traditional medicine. And if you've been listening from the beginning, you know that I left traditional medicine both in practice and as a patient because it didn't solve my problem. But oh my goodness, who am I to say that that's not going to work for you, that that's not your story? It didn't work for me because it approached my issue as this one size fits all. And I'm not going to do that to you and only show you a functional medicine perspective because healing isn't a one size fits all. I would be doing you a disservice if I did that. And traditional medicine has a lot of really good qualities. And I even recommend it to my clients in certain cases when I think medication really is their best option. So I want to encourage you, the listener, to befriend to people who think differently than you. I think that that's really important. That's how we grow. And that's how we release ourselves from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. So I need to set an example myself by doing that. Now, clearly, this is a topic y'all care about because I asked if you had any questions for Dr. Basil, and boy, did you show up. You sent me so many questions that I actually had to break them down into themes. And so we're going to start basic today. So Dr. Basil, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yes. This is so cool. Yeah. I like this in-person deal.
Me too.
Okay, so I'm just going to start off basic.
Yeah. Kind of old school, yeah.
Well, I had to get a windscreen because otherwise it'd be so echoey in here.
Yeah, definitely.
My whole house is wood, so there you go. All right, Dr. Basil, here's our first question for you. Can you just set the scene by defining what allergies are?
Sure. So essentially, when you're talking about allergies, you're talking about an immune response against something that your body should not be reacting to. So we have immune systems for a few different reasons. Obviously, the main function of the immune system is protect your body against things that could damage it, things like infections. And then what another thing the immune system does is it patrols your body at all times, looking for things that could cause other forms of damage to it. So cancer cells that are, we estimate that the average person produces one cancer cell in their body every hour, just naturally. But your immune system does a good job of snuffing it out almost every time. And things like cellular damage, which can lead to autoimmune disease, which can lead to breakdown of different tissues in your body, your immune system is there to clean that up. The problem with an allergy is your immune system is reacting to something out in the environment that poses no harm to you at all, but your immune system senses it as a threat. It produces this immune response, this allergic response. So for instance, you're allergic to peanuts, you eat a peanut, and you have this immune response, which actually ends up hurting your body, and it's not actually there to protect you against anything.
Thank you for that. And I would love to also ask you, because when you say the immune system, and I'm not a doctor, so this is just my understanding of the human body, that we have two immune systems. We have an innate immune system and we have an adaptive immune system. And allergies impact our adaptive immune system.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's one way, that's one framework for understanding the immune system, is that we have the innate immune system, which is there to immediately recognize and take out anything that's threatening to the body. But the innate immune system is limited because we have very complicated bodies. We don't have the ability to, and very complicated environments, obviously, we don't have the ability to produce within our genes a way to recognize everything that could potentially be a threat to us. And that's where the adaptive immune system comes in. Your adaptive immune system basically allows your body to, over time, we talked about the growth mindset versus the fixed mindset. The innate immune system is fixed. The adaptive immune system involves growth. It allows your body to learn what it is that is a threat and develop the tools to fight off unique threats in the environment or in other places that your body encounters them.
So do they communicate with each other, the innate and adaptive? Mm-hmm. How does that work?
So it's, you know, obviously it's a, you know, pretty complex process.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, maybe, but I just opened a can of worms.
Yeah. Well, essentially your innate immune system is there to sense that something is wrong. Okay. Your innate immune system senses, okay, there's a problem, but it can't specifically identify and produce a targeted solution to that problem most of the time, unless it's something that is extremely common, you know, something that is like parasites or certain things that just have been around for millions of years that our bodies have ways of rapidly taking care of a lot of the time. The something, for instance, let's take the COVID virus as an example. You know, we don't have built into our DNA ways of tackling a new virus that wasn't around when you and I were born.
Yeah.
So our adaptive immune system comes in. The innate immune system recognizes something is wrong. It gives that information to the parts of the adaptive immune system. And then the adaptive immune system adapts, as the name suggests, and produces an antibody in this case, or other targeted ways of recognizing and controlling the threat.
I know, I have to digest that for a minute. Yeah. I'm a slow processor.
No, it's take all the time you need. We can tie that back into allergies whenever you want.
Well, that's what I'm thinking about is when you're, let me just not get off target here.
Yeah.
All right. So my next question does relate to seasonal and nutritional allergies. Mm-hmm. Your typical response is to, I hate to use the word like manipulate, but to address the adaptive immune system.
With regards to an allergy, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, our understanding of most allergies is that they are related to the adaptive immune system. They're related to, for some reason, if you have an allergy, at some point in the process, your body became sensitized. That's what we call the recognition of this thing, this protein that you've become allergic to, whether it's a protein or some sort of other chemical, you've become sensitized to it. And from that point onward, your adaptive immune system, has a layer of aggression towards it.
Okay.
So it has an aggressive posture to it. And therefore, when you encounter it again, you have this inflammatory immune system response against it.
So back to your comment about peanuts, I'm thinking when I was a kid, you know what I'm going to ask.
Go on.
This is so fun.
Yeah.
I love this in person. Okay. So when I was a little kid, I could bring a peanut butter and jelly sandwich to school because peanut allergies were not so rampant like they are today.
Yeah.
Why do you think so many people are having more of an immune response to, peanuts have been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. Why are we having that response in so many people?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's a question that has been puzzling people in the allergy immunology community in my profession for a generation at least, because we are seeing this huge increase in not just peanut allergies, but in all food allergies among kids. We're not entirely sure why that is. I mean, some people have pointed to a link with the microbiome. So there's less microbial diversity early in life, and therefore kids are, their immune systems don't get enough practice against things that they normally would have. And that's why they have this almost skewed attitude towards things that are non-threatening, foods that for whatever reason are benign, but you know, these kids have developed allergic intolerances to them. But there are other theories out there too. Some people say that it's because of just other factors that are increasing eczema in kids. We know that kids that have really bad eczema, dry skin, are more likely to develop allergies to foods. And then some people say that we've also learned about 10 years ago that if you introduce peanuts to a child's diet early in life, like in the 6 to 12 month window, even if that kid is high risk based on their family history and based on other risk factors, if you introduce it at the right time, the kid will go on to not be allergic to peanut. So for a while, we were telling people avoid peanuts entirely. Don't feed it until the kid is 2 or 3 years old or whatever. We've done a complete 180 degree on that in the last 5-6 years or so.
Yeah, I find it interesting. So what I'm really interested in this topic. Mm-hmm. And I noticed, you know, there's obviously like gluten intolerance is really big right now. Milk intolerance, like lactose intolerance, or even just cow's milk in general, and peanuts. And like what do those things have in common, do you think? Or like, what, I don't know, what are your thoughts on like why certain foods?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's really hard to answer. Yeah.
Sorry.
Why? So no. These are great, great questions that are still head scratchers for a lot of us. We don't know why it is, why it happens to be that it's certain foods and not other foods, but there's a lot of theories out there. Some people say that just the processing of the foods has something to do with it. Like you may not get peanut, for instance, in everything, but you'll see foods that are processed through some sort of a processing step that involves peanut chemicals or other, you know, you see all this made in a factory that may contain nuts or that processes nuts containing some. I think it's complicated, and I think we're not quite at the point where we can really answer that specific question, but we, you know, there are a lot of things that are reacting against, you know, that we have had ways of reacting to this problem at the policy level. So for instance, you'll see that the 9 most common food allergies, those include things like milk, eggs, peanuts, and other nuts as well, are now required to be labeled on food. So you'll always see, if you read the nutritional label, it says contains, and then it'll say which type of allergen it does. So at the very least, we're now at a point where we can, you know, provide some comfort and some reinsurance to people that do suffer from these allergies.
So we talked about how food allergies are on the rise. Are seasonal allergies also on the rise?
They are.
They are. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So environmental allergies are definitely on the rise.
Interesting.
Yeah. And all these things are related, right? If you have food allergies, you're more likely to have environmental allergies and vice versa. So whatever it is that has led to more and more people's immune systems developing down this pathway, it's affecting a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. So you're seeing eczema, which is the skin condition, which is also called atopic dermatitis, an inflammatory skin condition. That's increasing. Food allergies increasing. Environmental allergies are increasing. Asthma is increasing. And all of these different disease processes involve the same parts of the immune system and the same immune pathways.
So where do you stand on the spectrum of, like, this is where I kind of go back and forth. And I'll just say, for my own healing journey, mm-hmm. I, for a long time, and I had mold, mm-hmm. mold toxicity, which is probably why I left traditional medicine, because who thinks to test you for mold?
Yeah.
Nobody thinks to, especially when my symptoms were GI related. So I was like, hey doc, I'm breathing just fine. Like, I don't think I have mold. Oh, but I oscillate between these two mindsets. Like, one mindset says, okay, Steph, you need to be the bubble boy, right? Mm. You need to mm-hmm. remove yourself from all of, you know, this, any toxins that you could come in contact with, you need to remove yourself from. And so for a year and a half, I only ate organic food that I made myself. Hmm. I would not eat out, which I think is, now I feel like, is a quality of life issue, because you should be able to go enjoy yourself in society. So I, on the one hand, I was removing myself from the situation, right? Removing mm-hmm. myself. And that's kind of this approach you're describing at the grocery store, right?
Yeah.
If this contains tree nuts, remove yourself from this situation, right? But then on the other side, I thought, well, shoot, if I had a healthy gut and a healthy body, I should be able to tolerate when I come into toxins. And like, I understand that both are important, right? Like, yeah, if I know that a house has black mold, I probably shouldn't live there.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I should be able to go out and, you know, grab dinner with my girlfriends.
Yeah.
And so as a physician, how do you manage those two things? Like, when you are treating patients with allergies, do you ever try to figure out what's causing this problem? Or are you just solely, okay, we have this problem, let's remove the bad stuff? Like, what is your approach?
So broadly speaking, I think you need both. You need to understand where the problem is coming from, what mm-hmm. it originates from, and try and stop it from happening in other areas in the future. Once the allergy has set in, if it's severe, you kind of have no choice, right? But to say you need to avoid this particular thing. That doesn't mean limit your quality of life outside of this targeted avoidance. I want my avoidant, when I tell somebody to avoid, I want mm-hmm. them to feel like the what I'm asking them to do is very specific mm-hmm. and easily understandable. So if I tell you avoid milk protein and I say, here's all the things that you, it might be in, and here's how you can identify it when you're out at the grocery store or when you're out mm-hmm. eating at a restaurant, that's what I want you to take away. I don't want you to take away, I need to go lock myself and, you know, be the bubble girl like you were for a year and a half. But then, yeah, you also want to understand if somebody has developed this particular mm-hmm. allergy, this particular condition that is so limiting on their life, I want to know why that's going on. I want to know if there are ways that I can prevent that this individual from having the same problem in affect other parts of their life in the future. Yeah. Or have their family members, siblings or their children someday, you know, prevent them from being affected by the same thing. So it all depends on the severity. It all depends on what you think the person can currently tolerate and what you think are complete non-starters. But I got to ask you also, when you did the strict avoidance and said, I'm not going to touch any toxins or experience any toxins, for a year and a half, how did you feel like that helped you versus your current approach right now being a little bit more adventurous?
Well, you know, I almost feel like I had to go through that to get to where I am today. Like I had to do the hard work. Yeah. Like I'm a big fan of John Wooden quotes. Mm-hmm. So one of his is, there is no substitute for hard work.
I didn't know you were a basketball fan.
Oh, yeah. I love John Wooden.
No, we've been talking for months. And yeah. Here's, we haven't talked about sports once until today. How'd that happen?
I mean, I can talk about 1960s sports. I don't know about today. Well, and I'm from Chicago. You know, Michael Jordan was.
Right.
I mean.
Yeah. So 60s through 90s, you can talk about sports. Yeah, but today, yeah, really since then. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I don't know. But, you know, I struggle with that. I don't know if I made the right choice or not. Mm. I don't know if going a year and a half, I think I learned a lot.
Yeah.
But I don't think I would recommend that to anybody that I worked with. I don't think I would recommend that. I would say my quality of life was not optimal in that time because I lived in fear. Like I was just I remember my goal with my doctor was I want to be able to go out to eat once mm-hmm. and not mm-hmm. be afraid to do that.
Right.
And when that's your goal in life, you kind of have to reevaluate the way you're living your life.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think that the extreme approach should be reserved for extreme situations. Mm. So rarely do I tell somebody that they need to go that far. Yeah. I don't know that I ever have. Usually it's try and live your life to the best quality that makes mm-hmm. sense for you within these very, very specific parameters that are based on what I've diagnosed you with.
Yeah. This is a good conversation. I like this.
Me too.
Let's go back
to talking about basketball.
He has some really great books. Have you read his books?
I haven't. John Wooden?
Oh, yeah. He's got Pyramid of Success, which I'm sure.
Oh, I've heard of that. Yeah. I've heard of that. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're ever making a big life decision, read that book.
I'm going to add that to my list for sure.
A Lifetime of Observations and Reflections on and Off the Court. That's another one of his. Okay. That's really good.
Awesome. Yeah.
But yeah, anyways.
And the fact that, I mean, I'm sure he wrote them in like the 1980s, and if they withstood the test of time, they've got to be great books.
Well, and the fact he lived to be like 100 years, I mean, 99, he was 99 when he died.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's from Indiana.
I knew that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I went to a Pacers game one time where they honored him. I used to live in Indianapolis.
Oh, get out. Yeah. My parents live in Fishers. Anyways, you all didn't need to know this.
Yeah. This is getting a little personal.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. I love this question. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is there a gold standard way to test for seasonal allergies and food allergies?
Mm-hmm. So the very best way to test for food allergies and seasonal allergies is through a skin test.
And this, why? I want to know why.
Okay. The skin test has been around for about 100 years. What it is, in different forms for about 100 years. Okay. And essentially, we have prepared purified extracts of the things that the proteins, specific preparation of the proteins that you could be allergic to within the food, within, you know, the pollen, the plant pollen, cat hair, things like that. And it's very predictable that if you scratch the skin, and it produces this characteristic mosquito bite look, mm-hmm. that is evidence that you have an allergy. There are blood tests also, but the blood tests, I mean, they're good. I'm not saying they're useless, but they're not quite as good as the skin tests in terms of just the studies that we've done correlating whether somebody tests positive and whether they actually react in the office. So I have a lot of patients who will test positive on a blood test to a food, let's say, and they've been eating this food and they haven't had a problem with it. And they think that they're allergic to it. And they're so hesitant to try it again that they're unwilling to do so unless they come into the office and do it under supervision and, you know, have an EpiPen on standby and all that. And a lot of times they do just fine eating it with, even with a slightly positive blood test. But the skin test is much stronger in terms of, if the skin test is really, truly positive, we tend to have a higher threshold before we consider having somebody try the food.
Is there, so the skin is more sensitive to the protein?
You know, based on the blood tests that we currently have, I'm not saying we'll never be able to have a test that is better than skin test. Maybe someday we will, but right now the skin test is the gold standard. The idea is, assuming your skin is healthy enough to do this test on. If not, then we got to do the blood test, even though it's not quite as good. It's only 80%.
So if you have like an older adult with really fragile skin, then you might.
May not be a good candidate. Okay. Or somebody with just, you know, really bad skin disease that covers their whole body or. Ooh. Yeah. That
happens.
It does. Yeah. There's some rough ones. But you know, it's the idea is that we scratch your skin with the thing that we think you're allergic to. And then that scratching of the skin, because it's introducing a little bit of the allergen just underneath your skin, it's safe. And if there's going to be an immune response, that allergic immune response that we talked about before, you're going to see it in the area where you scratch the skin.
Interesting.
And it's about more than 95% accurate versus the blood tests are about 80%.
Yeah. That I've heard that about blood tests. And some people have come to me with, like, they're just like places you can go order kits online now, I guess. I never know the validity of those or how reliable they are. Most of those that I've seen though are like finger prick. So it would be like a dried blood spot. So that'd be totally different than a, like, you know, a blood draw where you'd have vials of blood. Cause it's, so I don't know.
Work. I didn't know that they were finger prick tests. I wasn't sure whether they were finger prick or blood or saliva. Or other types of, you know, bodily samples that they were running. I don't need to get too graphic about that, but it's my understanding is the commercial tests that are at home, you know, direct to consumer test kits, they're not necessarily scientifically validated. And this is where we maybe are, you know, diverging in our thoughts, but I think that this one, those tests are, you know, there's nothing wrong with somebody if they really are curious about what it'll show them, if they want to pursue it as a, as one area where maybe they think they may learn something, but I would treat it as speculative. I don't think it's definitive. I don't think the I think that the claims that these companies make are not, they're able to sell the product because their claims are, it may help you, not it will help you with 100% certainty. So interpretation should reflect that, right?
If
you're getting the results of that test, take it with a slight grain of salt and say, this is what maybe is going on in terms of the foods that I'm eating.
Yeah, absolutely. I occasionally use a blood test for food sensitivities, but that's not, that's never my first go-to.
What is your first go-to usually?
I really like, we're going there. I really like stool tests.
Okay.
So I like to look at, so many people are on like probiotics and I don't know if that's a good thing or bad thing. I'm kind of indifferent about that, but it's nice when you can kind of, I use a PCR test. It's done at Georgia Tech. I like their technology.
Interesting.
And it kind of shows good bacteria versus opportunistic bacteria. It can show things like steatocrit, elastase one, beta glucuronidase. So you can see like, you know, are you breaking down fat? Are you breaking down estrogen? So I feel like having a screenshot of your gut is maybe sometimes more beneficial than here's a list of foods that you may be reactive to.
Right.
For the people that I'm working with. I also like organic acids. I like looking at, and that's what I've really gotten into over the last year is mitochondrial health. Like how, like for me, and this is just my own, this is my own hot take. I feel like the root of all disease is a lack of energy to fight it. That's what I've come to just in my own. This is not anything school taught me. This is just me being a curious person. And so that's kind of what I look at, and it's been helpful. Mm-hmm. It's been helpful, but food allergies, I have such a hard time with this. Another thing I like to look at is, which we kind of talked about for just a hot second before we recorded, is glyphosate, which is the weed killer Roundup.
Yeah, yeah.
And so one of the things that maybe wheat has in common with peanuts is that glyphosate is sprayed on wheat as a desiccant when it's harvested.
Sure.
And so do you have a glyphosate problem or do you have a gluten problem? Do you have a glyphosate problem or do you have a peanut allergy? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I don't know all the evidence around glyphosate in particular, but yeah, I mean, there's definitely a school of thought that says that if you're ingesting foods that have been sprayed with a lot of pesticides, that that's going to do some things to your gut. That's going to do some things to how your body treats these foods as they enter into your digestive system, whether it treats them as nutrition or whether it treats them as a threat. Like you said, I mean, I think this is also speculative territory where we don't have very strong evidence, but I mean, conceptually, is it possible? Yeah, certainly.
Something's causing this rise.
Something about the way that we live in the modern world and something about the way that we eat our diets is causing this rise, particularly in food allergies.
Yeah. Somebody that would be really cool to introduce you to would be Dr. Ailey Cohen. I don't know if you're familiar with her work.
I don't think I am.
I'll show you her book later.
Yeah.
She studies, she's a rheumatologist.
Okay.
But she studies environmental toxins, specifically like chemicals that are introduced into the world every year.
Really?
So I think that's just,
I'm sure we'd have a lot to talk about.
And she leans more conventional too, which I think it's pretty.
Yeah. We'd probably be looking at things through kind of a similar lens, but I'd be talking about a lot of these subjects.
Okay. My next question. Oh, how can you treat food allergies holistically, or can you treat food allergies holistically?
We are right on the verge of being able to treat food allergies more holistically than we have in the past. So let me explain what I mean by that.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So because I know I set that up. Yeah. All right. So when it comes to food allergies, we talked before that we diagnose somebody with a food allergy, and really the only treatment we've had for a generation is stay away from this food, read every label, have an EpiPen. If you accidentally eat it, give yourself the EpiPen treatment if needed, if it gets to a certain level. And go to the hospital if needed, or, you know, usually go to the hospital if it's severe enough to use the EpiPen. Now we are starting to treat food allergies with immunotherapy, just like we've had immunotherapy against environmental allergies, which, let me walk this back just a little bit. Yeah. Environmental allergy immunotherapy, you know it better as allergy shots.
Okay.
What that means, if you know somebody who's been through allergy shots, what they have gone through is really, if you think about it, a holistic process, because you are taking the things that they're allergic to in the environment, the pollens, the dust, the cat dander or dog or whatever it is, and you're slowly introducing it into their body in the form of a shot at a very, very small microscopic level that they can tolerate. And then you're gradually building that up. It's like an exposure and response treatment. Oh. It's the opposite of shutting yourself in, you know, and being the bubble boy or the bubble girl, right? It is exposure.
Like
it's gradual safe exposure. It's saying, okay, we're going to give you this much, this much, this much. And then eventually we desensitize you to the point where you have received a dose that you normally would encounter when you're out in the real world. The same thing, the same kind of process. So that's what allergy shots are for environmental allergies. It doesn't work, at least in the form of shots, with food. Soon, and this is something that is now FDA approved for peanut only. It's going to hopefully expand to other foods soon. We'll have the ability to do the same thing and do oral desensitization to food allergies. So now we have kids right now, you know, as we speak, there are people that are peanut allergic who are able to at least tolerate small amounts of peanut and not have to worry about having to go to the ER if they accidentally eat peanut, because they have gone through this process of what's called oral immunotherapy, where they have, they start out with a tiny, tiny amount that's not going to make them sick. And then they increase that amount a little bit, a little bit more, and a little bit more. And eventually they should be able to eat. They're, you know, desensitized to the level of one peanut, sometimes more.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think that's something that is, we're going to see a lot more of in the next several years.
Yeah.
But right now we're just right on the cusp of being able to do that. You can probably take a minute. Yeah.
I know. I tell every guest that like I'm a slow processor. It takes me a minute to digest because I'm really listening to what you're saying. And I'm not one of those people that thinks about the next thing that I'm going to say.
Yeah.
You know, I have to take in everything you're saying.
No, I appreciate that actually. Yeah. I feel like most people are the opposite of that, you know, wait to talk rather than listen and process. Yeah. So,
yeah. I'm going to process.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for a good conversation.
I'm just trying, like, I have a hard time picturing, like, you did a great job explaining it. It's not, but I have a hard time picturing what, like, how that actually looks like. So you're taking the piece of a peanut that people tend to have an allergy to, and you're putting a small dose inside a pill or something.
Yep.
And then you're increasing that dose. So you're taking this small dosage for so many days and then we're increasing.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. So it's basically a capsule that contains a certain amount of peanut protein. Starts very, very tiny, like a really, really, you know, less than 1 microgram. And then you slowly increase that amount. And that's essentially the process, you know. Each capsule is coded in, like, it's made very clear which one is which dose. And there's a stepwise process that the patient takes them.
Interesting. Well, I hope that works.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think it's at a point right now where it's working, but it could be better. Just like everything else, it needs fine tuning.
Sure.
And it needs to be optimized before it's ready for rinse and repeat for every single food allergy in the world. But I think that eventually, hopefully we'll get there someday.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, that's a holistic process. It's not a pharmaceutical. It's not like a foreign type of chemical. It's literally reprogramming the immune system through an exposure therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still have, I guess, questions about how that would work logistically, but that's probably above. Let me see. On to the next question.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So this is, and I say this with love.
Okay.
This is an area of opportunity that I feel like, and I've never been to medical school, but I have lots of friends who are doctors.
Okay.
And I hear that, you know, the common, complaint is a strong word, but there's not a ton of education on nutrition in medical school. And that maybe perhaps that's an area of growth or opportunity in medical school, but you work specifically with nutrition, like, right? You're working with food allergies. So is your education different or how do you equip yourself with knowledge on nutrition if that isn't your background?
In fairness, of course, medical school is 4 years and it's a large volume of knowledge to try and squeeze into 4 years. I mean, you're learning you're learning biochemistry, physiology at a more advanced level than you could in college. And you also have to learn the clinical side of medicine, learn pharmaceuticals and learn a lot of different things about, you have to see the different branches of the medical profession, right? You have to rotate through surgery. You have to rotate through pediatrics and see, psychiatry, you know, see all these different branches all while learning the basics. So it's challenging. I mean, I think that I work with nutrition. I'm not a dietitian. So my training is not in building and recommending specific diets for people, but my knowledge of nutrition is still in the broader sense, macronutrients, difference between macronutrients, micronutrients, and making sure that my patients who have somewhat restricted diets because of their disease are still achieving their nutritional goals, broadly speaking. So from that standpoint, I mean, we do learn a lot of these things in medical school, and especially people who are subspecialists who have an interest in this will take on the additional knowledge to try and be able to give the recommendations to patients with regards to what they're eating. Could there be a greater emphasis on it? Probably. And could there at least be kind of an introduction to, okay, nutrition is really, really important. It's one of the very basic fundamental aspects of a person's health. And at least we need to be, even if we are more concerned with treating diseases that are extremely hard to treat and then making diagnoses that are not just common sense, we still need to be able to have these conversations that are just going to feel basic and like common sense to somebody who spent a lot of time dedicated to picking up advanced knowledge and also learning how to direct them to the right, direct our patients, I should say, to the right resources when it comes to optimizing their nutrition. Yeah. And I think that this is going to require really, you know, a team-based approach in the future, because it's a lot to take on for what I just described to you, you know, is
extensive.
A summary of a doctor's medical training. You know, I do think it's probably a fair criticism to say that physicians need to reflect on how much more important nutrition is than perhaps we've given it attention in the past. But I don't necessarily think that the right place to talk about the specifics of nutrition is in the doctor's office. I think there are other team members that will hopefully have the right training and to be and be well equipped to do that.
Yeah, I know it's such a tough, you know, on the one hand, I feel like you vote for your health with your fork three times a day. If you're eating a meal three times a day.
That's a great way to put it. I haven't heard that before. Did John Wooden say that?
No, it might be like a Mark Hyman thing. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
Maybe Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan said that. And to me, I'm like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense that, you know, because people have to eat every day,
right?
We have, or, you know, we have to eat every day. Technically, we
do. I do. Yeah.
I don't know. I have to eat every day. I can only
speak for myself, but yeah.
And so because that's a daily practice, that's an area of opportunity where doctors can have a big influence on somebody's life because, and I know that this is like, I don't know if it's called an old wives' tale, but like, you are what you eat. Is that an old wives' tale? I don't know what those things are called.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's, you know,
just an old saying.
It's a saying. Yeah. It's a proverb, American proverb. Yeah.
That has some truth to it, right? If I eat McDonald's all day, every day,
you're a clown.
I'm going to feel a lot different than if I eat food that has better nutritional value. And so I think nutrition is a foundation piece of health. I also, you know, reflecting on my own education, when I was a kid in school, I was taught the food pyramid.
Yeah.
And
now that's completely out the window, right? We don't teach that anymore at all. I was too.
It's completely, but I have it memorized, right? I know, like, I know it by heart because that's what I was taught when I was a kid. And I feel like another area, and I agree, like, you guys are taught so much in school that it's hard. Like, what if we taught kids in school about nutrition? Like, whoa, we would all know this information and we can all be the wiser for it. I feel like that criticism exists because food is so important to our health.
100%.
And
food and lifestyle factors in general, day to day, are all very important to our health.
I'm that person that can see everybody's. Welcome to the dinner table.
Peacekeeper.
Well, not even just by default, just by default. You know, I grew up in a house where my parents disagreed on most things, but in a loving way, like in a respectful. So I grew up hearing about, you know, like one was pro-life and one was pro-choice. And I was like, oh, well, the basis of this is noble, right? Preserving human life. And the basis of this is noble, preserving human rights.
Interesting.
Okay, I get both.
Yeah.
You know? And so the rule was at the dinner table, Stephanie, you have every right to disagree with anything we say, but you have no right to be disagreeable. So the moment you become disagreeable, you lose your right to disagree. And so that's kind of how I approach life now.
Good.
There was your little Stephanie nugget for the day. Let's see, my next question. Okay, so you weren't familiar with glyphosate, so I don't know if you'll be able to answer that question. So there was a question on thoughts on glyphosate and the increase in celiac disease.
I'll have to do more reading about that
I'll point you to a good book. I follow an MIT research scientist that studies this. She's got good stuff.
No, I'd love to.
We kind of talked about this already. Like, why do you think dairy intolerance is on the rise? But we have two questions about this, so I'll bring it up again.
I will say briefly that I think dairy intolerance is a little bit in a different category because it's not really an allergy. It's, well, if they're talking about lactose intolerance, which I assume they are, lactose intolerance is, so the lactose intolerance is different than an allergy to dairy. So an allergy is, you know, you're reacting to the protein that's inside the milk. Lactose intolerance is you have a hard time in your digestive system processing the lactose, which is actually a carbohydrate. It's not a protein. And that's largely genetic. I don't know that lactose intolerance is on the rise. I think maybe we're just recognizing it more because what it is lactose intolerance is essentially you can eat a certain amount of lactose dairy products and feel fine. If you go above that, you've reached your limit for the day that is your body's able to digest. So a lot of us, myself included, we have relative lactose intolerance, meaning I can eat two slices of pizza, feel totally okay. If I eat a third, then that's pushing it because I've reached my limit in terms of how much lactose I can digest. And I think just we've introduced milk products, cheeses, among other things, into so much of our food at every meal that we're probably just pushing the limits, generally speaking. And that's why we're seeing more dairy intolerance right now than we used to.
I've never heard that before. That's interesting. Are there different types of dairy intolerances then? Lactose just being one of them?
So I think that's a good question. Probably, yeah. I mean, lactose is the most famous one and probably the most common one that you're going to encounter. But yeah, you can have other types of dairy milk protein intolerance. You can have, especially in kids, you can have other forms of milk protein allergic reactions that are more like the classical anaphylactic type of food allergies. But in adults, I think you're most likely to encounter lactose intolerance.
What about the, is it called the alpha-1 casein protein? Am I saying that right?
Yeah, so there is casein, which is a protein in milk. Yeah.
People have responses to that?
They can. Yeah, you can be allergic to casein. You can be, there's casein and whey, which I believe are the two different types of protein, you know, that are in cow's milk. So yeah, you can have allergies to either of them.
Interesting.
That's why you can go to the GNC store and buy whey protein, you can buy casein, you know, you can buy separate. So I'm told.
Well, this is just speculation here. So I started drinking local goat's milk because I read that it doesn't have a high level of that protein like cow's milk does.
Interesting.
And I do so much better with goat milk than I do with cow. And I didn't test this one. I don't know why, but just speculation.
Yeah. And that's interesting. And, you know, I think a lot of what I tell people is just experiment. And if you, unless you have a very serious life-threatening allergy, if you have that, don't experiment with the thing that you're allergic to. But if it's a relatively mild intolerance, hey, I get a stomach ache for a little bit, I get a headache, I'm less fun at parties, then you can just do trial and error. See what works for you. Maybe the goat protein, for reasons that we don't understand, the goat's milk just sits better with you than cow's milk.
Yeah, I like the idea of milk because it's so nutrient dense. But I also, cow milk does not like me, you know. Yeah. So, you got to do what you got to do.
There's other milk out there.
So the next question is, how does a cow's hormone fluctuation impact the milk that they produce and therefore impact our health?
I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that question, actually. So I don't know a lot about the cow's hormone fluctuation.
Maybe they're asking about because cows are given hormones these days. A
veterinary question. Okay.
I don't know.
Then maybe. But even then, I'm not entirely sure how that would affect the cycle of milk production inside the cow. If we can get a large animal's veterinarian here, I'm sure we could have a really
good conversation. Well, and hormones fluctuate throughout the day. So what time of the day is the milk being produced?
Usually in the morning, right? That's when they milk the cows. So I'm told. I don't know. So, I don't have a cow farm, but it's
Well, you saw mine in the backyard.
Right. Yeah. What time do you? Yeah.
That's a great question. Whoever asked that question, if you find out the answer, call us.
Yeah.
Because that's a really insightful question. That's somebody who thought for a long time about what to ask you because that's a thoughtful question.
It is. You can imagine that could affect the nutrient content of the milk and that could affect a lot of things. So yeah. But I just don't know how it would.
Was the cow stressed when you milked the cow?
Totally.
I mean, there's a lot of factors at play there.
Yeah.
This is a hard question for me. I have a hard time understanding this. Can you talk about the connection between histamine intolerance, gut health, and interstitial cystitis?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. We're not entirely sure if there is a connection between those three things, and if so, what the connection is. I can talk about gut health. Let's focus on that in particular, because I think that what this person is asking has to do with gut microbiome diversity. So gut health, of course, you talked before about your stool tests, whereby you can recognize how rich in microbes, in healthy microbes versus unhealthy microbes your gut seems to be, at least in sort of the, you know, relatively crude way that we can understand it right now, which is hopefully going to become more scientific in the future. But there is certainly a connection between gut health, food intolerance, and certain other conditions, whether they're autoimmune diseases, whether they're more functional disorders like interstitial cystitis. We do seem to find that repeatedly somebody who has low microbial diversity in their gut, or somebody who has the overabundance of, let's say, the wrong types of bacteria in their gut, they tend to be more likely to have these types of conditions. The answer to that, I mean, it's really hard to say that there's a perfect silver bullet answer to fixing your gut health. It's usually more of a chronic thing, as you're aware of. You know, you talked about people taking probiotics. The evidence for probiotics in terms of like taking a pill is shaky, but the evidence is really, really good when it comes to things like increasing the amount of microbial diversity in your food, eating some fermented foods, some foods that are enriched, and then getting a good dose of fiber and what we call prebiotics. So molecules that are in food that can encourage the growth of healthy bacteria. And I think, you know, you had alluded to that a little bit before, but yeah, like certain fatty acids can do that. Fibers can do that. So that's, I think, you know, if there is a connection between the gut, is there's a connection between the gut and a lot of different things when it comes to a person's health. But if there's one thing to learn from that, it's like you said, increasing the richness of your diet, increasing the diversity of your diet, maybe stay away from the McDonald's at every meal, unless you're trying to make a documentary about it. But yeah, I think that's already been done. Yeah,
that has been done. Nobody needs to do it again.
I agree.
Well, and I think, you know, whoever asked this question probably, you know, to be fair, has more going on than what we know about in the sentence. And so I have a hard time answering questions where I don't know the whole story. And there is definitely a story behind this question. Okay. My last two questions, I wrote these.
Okay.
And I ask every doctor that I am friends with, I ask them about this because this is what I struggled with when I worked as an occupational therapist in nursing homes. I worked in hospitals, kind of all over the place. And the hardest thing that I had to deal with was not patients, it was the system. It was, I was given a limited time with a patient and I was required to do what's called point of service documentation, which means that I needed to type all of my notes while I was seeing the patient. In my line of work, that was really hard, if you can imagine, because you can't have one hand on a gate belt and helping somebody on and off a toilet, and the other hand on your iPad typing a note. That just doesn't happen. And so I was wondering if doctors ever run into this issue and how you navigate that space and provide, you know, quality of care.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a huge issue right now in medicine, because on the one hand, you're expected to document just about every single finding that you see with a patient. But at the same time, if you're seeing 25, 30 patients a day, that really leaves you very little time to actually sit down and think and try and help them address each of these problems that they're coming to see you for. So that is a huge problem right now. I'm not going to pretend that it's not. I think that hopefully, I mean, there are some creative solutions being introduced to that right now. And the problem is getting attention. It's not one of those problems that is just being completely brushed aside. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right that I think on the one hand, my approach to it is try and be present with the patient as much as possible. If I do type, I always ask, hey, I'm going to, is it going to bother you if I type while we talk? And then, yeah, so that's how I start the encounter. I don't ever start typing in the room unless I've asked the patient, you know, if it's okay with them. And then if there is one of those moments where you really need to devote your complete attention to it, if it's something that is not routine, but you know, 90% of what you're going to see in the office as a physician is something that you've seen before or more, something that you have a general approach to it and you're not on autopilot. You're still thinking, but you can type while you do it.
Okay.
There's still going to be some things that catch you off guard that are very unusual. And when that happens, you do have to be able to divert your attention away from what's going on the screen to what's going on with the person. Yeah. That's the best solution that I've come up with.
Yeah, to it.
Yeah, maybe somebody smarter than me will come up with a you know, an even better solution than that, yeah, and then share it with the rest of us.
I know, like I almost wish, and I know that and I started to see this in the hospital right before I left, was dictation, mm-hmm, where you can speak into a microphone, yeah, and that can move a bit faster.
It can.
But yeah, that was the hardest thing. They don't teach you that in school, you know.
Right. Like, no, they don't.
You know, you're gonna be valuable based on your productivity, and that was the hardest part about being an OT for me.
Yeah. No, I can certainly imagine that, because it takes a lot of the fun out of your job. Also, I mean, you're there to help this person. You're there to get them up and moving around, and
it's like
you're not there you're not there to just sign a chart.
Yeah, I would understand if my job wasn't so physical, mm-hmm, but it's, you know, sir, can you pause your shower for a second? I need to type a note. Okay. And my last question for you, and this is just, I got this off of snooping on, mm-hmm, your pages. I know you're working on, so you've just published a paper on app. Let me back up. Yeah. My favorite part about doctors, when they have a personal connection to the work. And I love that you have a personal connection to the work that you're doing, because I feel like that makes you more empathetic as a physician. You understand someone's pain and suffering when they come to you and say, "Doc, I have asthma."
I hope so.
Mm-hmm. And so I know you're working on publishing some things. Can you tell us more about that?
So it's really in the line of what we've been talking about with regards to lifestyle factors and how important they are, and just how important, you know, baseline health is in general when it comes to treating disease. So in terms of asthma, I mean, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about asthma.
No, we didn't. We didn't spend any time.
We could have. A lot of what we were saying about food allergies, about seasonal allergies, applies to asthma too. But I think when it comes to asthma, you really got to look at it as a breathing disease. Mm-hmm. And one of the triggers for it is strenuous physical activity. So you go out and you start running, and then, you know, a lot of asthmatics will say, I feel short of breath, and that's one of my triggers. But that trigger is also a treatment for it. So routine physical activity, we've known this for a really long time, for decades, that routine physical activity leads to better outcomes in people with asthma. It expands your lungs. It teaches your body how to, your airways, how to open up during physical activity better. It doesn't cure the disease. It doesn't make it go away, but it teaches your body how to tolerate certain states better. It increases the strength of your muscles, and it helps just relax your mind when you're in that state where you may, you know, previously have been felt overwhelmed or freak out, have a lot of anxiety around it. It teaches you how to control your breathing and just control your emotional state in that moment as well. So that's how I became interested in exercise-induced asthma and studying that and making that part of really one of the focuses of my career.
So cool.
Thanks.
So cool.
Yeah. Cause I mean, I was that kid. I was, you know, the kid that ran when I loved playing sports. I loved exercising, but I did have this issue where I needed to use my inhaler, needed to use breathing treatments a lot of times, because you just wear yourself out, and, you know, you have to treat that in some way. And it never felt good to be in that position. And that's really all we had at that time were reactive treatments rather than proactive treatments. But now I get to hopefully tell people that they can be proactive about their disease. And I'm not saying don't use the pharmaceuticals at all when they're recommended when you need them. But in addition to the pharmaceuticals, if you can find ways to incorporate exercise into your lifestyle, that's going to really, really help you over the full course of your life in managing something that you're going to have for an entire lifetime.
Wow. And did I get this right? You recently ran a race.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to talk it up. It was just a quarter marathon. It wasn't like a full marathon or anything
still,
like that. But yeah, I've done one half marathon in my life. That's the longest race I've ever run.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I do. I like to run races from time to time.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, when you are asthmatic, even if you're mild asthmatic like me, every single one feels like an accomplishment.
Absolutely.
It's something that if you weren't training to do it, you know, then you probably would be limited in how well in your ability to do it at all. I don't like to talk myself up or brag about myself to my patients, but I guess I can use myself as an example for
You
brought it up.
Yeah. I brought it up.
Yeah. And I did just publish that paper about, me and other co-authors published a paper about talking about exercise with asthmatic patients. And it'll be the first and hopefully a series of papers that we release about that.
That's really cool that I love what you said, and I'm going to butcher it.
Okay.
But
go right ahead.
You said something about, I'm so going to butcher this, but when somebody has asthma, that response that you have, when you're exercising, but then exercising is also the treatment. I totally butchered it, but you know what I'm saying?
Well, good thing we're recording this.
But I love that the thing that is that marker to you that the problem's wrong could also be the thing that helps you endure through.
Yeah,
that.
I think the trigger is also the therapy.
That's what you said. The trigger is the therapy.
Yeah.
See, this is why I have guests.
Yeah. I didn't write that line down.
Well, is there anything that you feel like you wanted to mention that I didn't ask you a question about?
I feel like I found a way to talk about all the things that I wanted to talk about based on your questions and your community's questions, which were all terrific.
Yeah,
but
they asked the questions. I had those last two and that was it.
Yeah, no. I usually, when I get to the end, I'm like, yeah, I wanted to talk about this. I never got a chance. I feel like you guys gave me a chance to talk about everything that I came here to say. So I think just in general, there's, we'll maybe end by talking about just this. The importance of these conversations between conventional medicine, traditional medicine, whatever you want to call it, and our growth as a profession, and the things that I think that we're going to be learning, hopefully, from functional medicine and from whatever you want to call non-conventional health.
I know, it's so good.
Yeah, non-conventional health communities, which I think neither of us should be writing each other off. We need to be having these conversations. Yeah. There's room for growth everywhere. And, the more that we can talk about and talk especially about things where we really do agree, like about the importance of fundamental health, the importance of good nutrition, of physical activity, that's a hard place to disagree. So we need to keep having these conversations.
I love that. Somebody once told me that we have more in common. We all have more in common than we don't, but the things that we don't have in common are important.
Yeah.
Like our different, we have more in common than we do different, but our differences are important. And I so appreciate you. My goal is to connect with good people.
Yeah, definitely.
Michael, and you're a good person.
Oh, well, thank you.
I've been following your good person journey too.
Even though you lean crunchy. Yeah. You're a good person.
Hey, you know what? I'll tell you this. I suffered from migraines for a very long time. And, there's nothing like a Frova when you have a migraine, right? there's a time and a place for conventional medicine. And like you said, I don't write anybody off. That's just not the way I want to live my life.
Yeah. None of us should.
But I appreciate, and for you, the listener, I hope that you can have conversations with people in your life where maybe you disagree on some things, but, Dr. Basil has 100% of my respect. Just because maybe we see things differently doesn't mean that we don't respect each other. I won't speak for him, but doesn't mean that.
No, you're absolutely right. I echo what you said.
I feel like I learned a lot from this conversation and maybe even learn more sometimes from people that I don't, I don't speak his language. So this was great. I really enjoyed having you
here in my home. Yeah.
And
it's a great home, great neighborhood.
I look forward to reading more of your research.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. And thanks to everybody who sent in a question.
Yes. Thank you, everybody. All right. Well, we covered quite a bit. We talked about how the immune system works, what's the relationship between seasonal and food allergies, how allergy testing works. Is there a way to treat food allergies holistically? What is histamine intolerance? Why are foods like dairy, peanuts, and gluten the most common allergies? And how do doctors treat food allergies and equip themselves with knowledge on nutrition? My encouragement to you now is to go out and find people who think differently than you and become their friend. I think that this world would be a much less polarized place if we all did that. You can learn something from people with a different perspective. If you only surround yourself with people who think the same way as you, you are not setting yourself up for growth, right? All right, everyone, time to go back out in the real world now. Be well and be kind.